Welcome to Talking New Energy, a podcast from Delta EE, the New Energy Experts. We'll be talking about how the energy transition is developing across Europe, with guests who are working at the leading edge of this transition. Hello, and welcome to the episode. Today, we're looking at the topic of regulation and the role it plays in the transition from old to new energy. Although many aspects of markets have been liberalised in the energy sector, in many countries, and well, maybe every country, energy is certainly not a completely free market. Regulation plays a critical role, both with competitive markets and the networks, which are more like natural monopolies. So regulation and the policies underpinning them are critical, and they've typically been built around old energy and now need to evolve and facilitate or even lead the way to new energy. So regulation, important, maybe not as exciting as some shiny new business models, but really critical. So I'm delighted to be joined today by three members of the Regulatory Assistance Project, or RAP for short. So let's say hello to each of you, and I'll ask each of you to pick out one aspect of regulation and the energy transition that really excites you, or an example of best practice that you'd like to share. So first of all, Chief Executive of RAP, Rich Sedano. Hello, Rich.
Hello, John. Yes, this is Rich Sedano. And I guess the aspect of the energy transition that excites me the most is bringing energy decisions down to individuals, activating and enabling people to make choices on how they consume and also how they might produce energy and to contribute to the larger grid.
And I guess that's a radical change from regulation as it maybe was, I don't know, 10 years ago, or maybe even as it still is in some parts of the world.
I don't think it's overstating to say that the origins of regulation come from kind of a paternalistic approach to providing service to people and expecting people to just appreciate what they get. And yeah. I think now we're activating people on the other end, the citizens, to make their own choices and to design the service that they want.
And Rich, for our listeners that don't know the Regulatory Assistance Project, or RAP, in a nutshell, what does RAP do?
Sure, let's give you a short tour. We're an independent non-government organization that was founded in 1992 by some former United States utility regulators who wanted to provide regulators with some policy services that from an organization that was oriented toward regulators and not organizations that are mostly serving industry or advocates. So we provide policy advice to governments, and we've been doing that in the US since 1992, in China since 1999, and in India and Europe since 2009. And I think it's fair to say that when governments ask us for help, it's because they think that clean energy is underrepresented and they want to look at what they do and change what they do in order to strike a better balance.
Fantastic. Well, really looking forward to hearing some of your experiences as we get into the discussion. We're also joined by European Programme Director Jan Rosnau. Hello, Jan.
Hi, John. Great to be here on your podcast.
Thanks for joining. Jan, what aspect of regulation or example really excites you? What would you like to share with us?
Since I started working for RAP, what I found is that in Europe, most countries are still really playing catch up when it comes to regulation, with advances in technologies and, you know, the increasing potential for the demand side, for example, to play a much bigger role. And, you know, with the advent that we now see of electric vehicles, and you had many episodes on your podcast before about what that means for the energy system, but also, you know, the electrification of buildings, there's now ample opportunity to really take advantage of this inherent flexibility that we're adding to the system. But regulation in Europe is too often, as you say, designed for the old energy system, and sometimes even prevents and makes it more difficult, you know, for flexibility, for demand-side services to access markets and to provide services that would actually better the energy system to the advantage of all consumers. So that's something that I observed in Europe since I've worked for RAP, this divergence between what technology is and industry is and where regulation is.
Yeah, and how quickly do you see that gap closing, Jan, or is that your day job is working away to try and close that gap?
Exactly, and we see some signs that is happening. I think regulators increasingly understand the challenges and the opportunities that these changes bring, and they're looking into ways of addressing that. So we see some positive signs, and also at European Union level, there's new regulation, new laws, and we can talk about that later perhaps, that requires more innovation in regulation and how we deal with the energy system. So I think there are signs to be hopeful. It's the pace that we're worried about. It's not quick enough. We need to accelerate that.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Jan. And last but not least, hello, Shoshana Pato, Senior Advisor at RAP. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jan. Thanks a lot for having me here.
You're based in Europe as well. What aspect of regulation would you like to highlight, or what example would you like to share?
Yes, I'm based in Europe as well. I'm in Budapest, Hungary, so you have to excuse me if I am, answering questions through a Central and Eastern European lens. What I think is that we are living through very exciting times in energy because things change really rapidly. The many triggers provided in the past by public policy towards a cleaner energy system, for example, in the form of renewable support, is no longer needed. I think the energy transformation has now a life of its own. Technologies evolved quite a lot, and consumers as well gradually learn how to live with all the upcoming opportunities. And I'm sure that this will spread very quickly as well. So the exciting aspects of regulation for me is to keep up with the pace of change, which is all around us, and have an open mind to solutions that, traditionally we would call out of the box solution, but they are not out of the box anymore, and we need these solutions very much. And by an open mind, I mean the willingness to take risk in regulation, like these sandbox approaches, and motivate companies, especially regulated companies, financially, to explore these new options with the view of containing the costs and the social support for this transition.
And these sandboxes that you mentioned and the idea of regulators taking risk, that's risk is always there to some degree, but taking risk, actively taking risk, is maybe a bit scary for many regulators. The sandboxes are good experiments, ways to play and test new ideas. How widespread do you see the sort of this appetite for risk or sandboxes or innovation across Europe, Shoshana? Is it in one or two countries, or do you see a real trend towards regulatory sandboxes and experiments and innovation?
Well, I don't see a clear trend. I mean, it's here and there, and usually it's in the western part of Europe. And in general, regulators, they don't have a big appetite for risk. So this is something they have to have, like a cognitive shift in this. I mean, you have to take risk, otherwise the cost will be very high.
Yeah. And on that theme, I'm sure we have some regulators, maybe ex-regulators, listening to the podcast. I think regulators have got a really tough job because they're mandate is to protect customers. They don't want to be a brake on innovation. They want to facilitate the energy transition, but they're not incentivized, or they don't have the mindset of taking risks. So I think it's really hard. They've got lots of challenges. And my first question to the three of you is, how do you think regulators should balance out these risks of being conservative on one hand, protecting customers, but on the other hand, going with the way the industry is changing, taking some risks, and not being a brake on innovation? Who'd like to go first with that?
Well,
Well, John, this is Rich, and what I'll say as a non-European in this conversation is that one of the challenges for government generally and for regulatory organizations in particular is, as Zsuzsa said, to keep up with rapid change is hard, but they have to try to do it because one solution for managing risk is to get more information. Mm-hmm. And another solution for managing risk is to engage in a collaborative way, as you use the term sandbox, but my interpretation is to engage the community, to bring them into the problem and bring them into this search for the solution. I think when regulators are isolated, and don't have enough information and don't know how the community will react to opportunities, it's easy for them to fall back to business as usual. But when they see the opportunity for progress and get educated about it and also engage the stakeholders around them, that gives them the opportunity to have more confidence to make a decision that might be risky, but might also have some very clear opportunities for benefit and to see how those risks can be managed and perhaps minimized. So I think there are ways of managing in a environment like this where there is a lot of change. And I think regulators can take advantage of those ways more than they do.
Rich, that sounds logical, very logical if explained. From your last comment, why are they not doing more of that? What's stopping them, or what's holding them back from that in your experience?
Perhaps I could jump in there, John, if you don't mind. So I think there's an important difference in terms of the remit and the mandate that regulators have in different parts of the world. And in Europe, when you compare what regulators traditionally have done and are allowed to do, it's more restricted, for example, compared to the US, where Rich is based. So regulators in Europe understand themselves mainly as economic regulators, I would say. Mm-hmm. And are less willing to interfere in other areas, where in the US, I think you have more willingness and more powers sitting with a regulator that allow them to do that. And Rich could probably elaborate on that point.
Okay, but yeah, and what you're saying there about less willing to interfere, and using the example you said earlier on about demand side flexibility and how you integrate that into the electricity system, is that a mandate to interfere, or is that a mandate to remove barriers, or is that a mandate to redesign the market, or does it all boil back to the economics and doing things that are the lowest cost for the customer?
Well, I think if there's a clear perspective for the regulator to also contribute to the whole net zero agenda in Europe, that would require possibly a change in the mandate, at least in some countries, to allow the regulator to be more creative. And we have seen good examples in other parts of the world, and even in Europe and in some of the member states, where change is happening and regulators are willing to do more. But I think so far we have seen baby steps, but we haven't seen the steps that are required to really accelerate the transition.
Okay, and can you give us an example of where, the baby steps, Jan, that you think are really good, or steps that are really progressive? And then alongside that, what's stopping regulators in other countries doing that, where maybe they've got the mandate, you're encouraging them, the industry is encouraging them, why are they not moving forward more quickly?
So on the first point, what are good examples? We've actually done a bit of research on that about a year ago, and which Zsuzsa has led. And one of the places in Europe that has probably gone the furthest is actually the United Kingdom. Ofgem, with their RIIO framework, it's not perfect, but it essentially means that we focus more on outcomes and not on inputs. And RIIO, in theory, allows Ofgem to direct regulated entities to deliver a whole range of outcomes, including low carbon outcomes that we want. So I think that's an example of progressive and innovative regulation. It's not perfect and it's in transition. And of course, it's just being reviewed currently. But there's a lot of potential with that kind of regulatory framework to do more. Your second question, you know, what's holding regulators back? I think there's a whole combination of factors at play. I think risk we talked about already, but I think it's also to do with regulatory cultures and the kinds of people who work for regulators have been trained to do regulation a certain way. So I guess there's a whole set of barriers that has to do with the way how we have done regulation in the past, and then transitioning away from that is a significant step for how we do regulation, and that's not always easy to do for institutions.
Yeah, okay, so real institutional treacle you have to wade through, that the change in culture is really hard. In sticking with Europe for now, Jan or Shoshana, what could be done specifically to help with that, or where are you encouraging, how are you encouraging regulators to change that mindset or that culture? And I think it's things like knowledge sharing from one market to another market, or giving them confidence. How can you overcome some of this institutional treacle?
Well, knowledge sharing is always very good. And I think it's not at the intensity it should be. And I guess some regulators already have some experience, even within Europe, so in some member states. And some member states are really looking for, you know, experiences around to have at least a sense of a lower risk. And going back a little bit to the risk, I think one of the problems is a risk of change is seen by the regulators, but the risk of inaction, it's not so clear. So there is a risk involved in not. And I think that's a cognitive problem, not only with regulators, it's with all of us.
Yeah. Okay, so using the example of demand side flexibility, the risk of not unlocking that resource is higher balancing costs, or even a less stable system that doesn't have the same flexibility resources that you'd have if you had that demand side flexibility. So really reframing the argument, Shoshana, is that what you mean?
Yeah, plus, you know, in some countries, this urge to have more flexibility is stronger. In some countries, lower, depending on your capacity mix, you know, all the national circumstances. So even though the European legislation requires all national regulators to change their regulations, but some regulators, like, it's a more pressing problem. And for others, it's not so much. It will be a problem in the future, but regulators usually like to, you know, focus on short-term problems.
Okay. Rich, if we go back to the US, the regulatory setup is quite different there. How do you see the differences between the US and Europe? And given that most of our listeners are in Europe, are there particular things you think Europe could learn from the US when it comes to regulation?
Jan did highlight an important difference in the willingness of some U.S. regulators, and it would be right to say that there's a spectrum of different attitudes across the U.S. about this, but the willingness of regulators to loosen up their processes and to open them up to more of a collaborative and engaging type of process. We've tended to be invited into helping states like Oregon and North Carolina on really energy transition collaboratives that engage many people. I don't want to say hundreds, but certainly many dozens of people to participate in a series of meetings over many, many months, sometimes multiple years, to work out what are the priorities that are most important. And one of the important things, John, is to get people off of their talking points. You know, people start with a position, And you, of course, want them to advocate for their interests. But, and that's what happens in the regulatory process is people state their positions very clearly. But in a collaborative, you're forced to deal with other people's positions. And eventually, you have to, if you're going to participate sincerely, you have to reflect on how your position matches up or can be in some way resolved with the positions of others in the community, recognizing that the only way you're going to get what you want is if other people get what they want. And so that kind of synthesis creates new opportunities for solutions that doesn't necessarily present easily in the traditional regulatory process. And I think in an environment characterized by innovation, and I think what we're talking about really is how innovation has imbued the regulatory marketplace, the power sector today, is imbued with innovation. It is, I think, essential for the people responsible for decisions to hear from many people in a synthetic way, as opposed to the evidence-based approach that has characterized regulation for many decades. So I think that's what we're starting to see in the U.S. that's working, that I would want to encourage others to figure out how to implement in their own ways.
That's really interesting. It's almost how you approach it, because regulators will consult a lot of the time, but I guess consult and collaborate are really different things. Have you got an example, Rich, of I guess can you highlight something specific or a process, or make it real for our listeners to see how that might work or what it resulted in?
In the state of North Carolina, a new governor came into office with a decarbonization agenda, but he presented that agenda in a state that was not used to talking about climate change at all. And so what we helped the administration to do in that situation is to create a process that would engage utility, the advocates, cities, other local and NGO organizations to come together to talk about what this will mean for North Carolina, and to make it real, to go from the large scale objective that the governor laid out to how might we do this. And that has led to a series of meetings that have happened over the course of a couple of years that has raised the level of conversation there, and is, I think, going to lead to significant changes. These things don't happen fast. That's one other thing that sometimes troubles people. They want to see an administrative process, a government, act very quickly. And we listen to Greta Thunberg, and we are motivated to do something. But the fact is that if government can move as fast as it can, as slow as it might appear, that's excellent. So I think my admonition to government is do the best you can. And that means engaging with the sense that you're going to act at the end. In the state of Oregon, they were challenged to basically say, how might we change the way utilities are compensated? And in a collaborative process that we were involved with, they came up with ways to do that, and now they're going to be implementing a performance system of regulation there. So when you're in it, it takes a lot of time, but when you get through with it and the process works quite a bit better, then you can see all the benefits. The gold standard for this, and I won't say that it's even met all of its own expectations, the New York Reforming the Energy Vision process. That's been the most ambitious process of this kind, and it has made many, many reforms. It has changed the utility culture. People are still unhappy with areas of progress that have not been achieved, but it is, I'd say, in the US, the most ambitious of these kind of things.
Yeah, I guess, Rich, regulation's never going to move fast enough for some innovators in the market. But as you say, going as fast as it can is all you can ask. Susanna and Jan, looking at Europe, you mentioned the idea of sandboxes. And we talked earlier about innovation to gather more information to understand risks better or minimize risks. How well do you see the concept of sandboxes working in Europe? Because on one hand, I think they're absolutely fantastic. On the other hand, they could be used just to show, look, we're doing something, but then to translate the outcome of the sandbox into something tangible can be harder. So I'm quite curious to see what you think about how sandboxes are being used and the potential for sandboxes to really facilitate and drive change.
Well, my feeling is that simply we are still in the, you know, having more sandboxes stage. So, I mean, my understanding is that there are only a few, and even those, you know, results from those sandboxes is not made public, maybe because these are still ongoing things. So I think we are still in the phase when we need more and more sandboxes in various national settings, because one country is not the same as another country. So having a sandbox results in one country is not directly applicable to another one. So I'm ready to talk about, you know, how to make sandbox level trials to commercial operation as a power plant generator would say. It's too early, I guess.
Yeah, okay. So we're seeing some activity, but difficult to see what tangible is coming out of that yet, and it's early in the process. Yeah, and anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I think in addition to sandboxes, which are great to test and trial new ways of doing things, I think we should not forget, as we move into the next decade, we also have a completely refreshed energy and climate policy framework at European Union level, which of course will have big impact in Europe. And there's a lot of interesting innovations in there. It's not perfect by any means, but there's a lot of good things in the new framework that will require and incentivize regulators and policymakers to change things. You know, for example, to open up markets for demand side flexibility. That's one of the areas that is in that package. Or to introduce better tariffs that reflect network costs and offer consumers benefits if they shift consumption outside of the congested areas in the peak hours. So that's, I think, what we should also keep in mind, that there's a new framework that will drive change in addition to the sandboxes, which are important, but I don't think they by themselves can accelerate the change to the extent that we need to see.
And how do you see the link between the frameworks coming out at the European level and then the national action? Because innovators will get terribly excited by these frameworks and then tear their hair out sometimes at the national implementation of the frameworks. So we've talked about speed a few times. Do you think that will be fast enough, or how fast will it be?
Well, I think you put your finger there on a really important point, John. We see that not just in the regulatory space, but in many, many other areas in Europe, where there's different speeds of implementation and also different quality of implementation. And I think we're going to see that in the next decade again. But I'm optimistic, and I think we will see more countries that will take the lessons learned from other countries and progress. But yes, there will be parts of Europe that, if they're not careful, might miss out on some of the real innovation that will take place and will need to take place, given, we talked about it at the beginning, the new technologies that are now being used and customers wanting to be much more engaged. So I'm optimistic, but I think you're right that implementation is always the hard bit. Agreeing on the framework is the easy part.
Okay. Keeping on time, so we had a potential discussion point, which I don't think we'll have time for, about the role, what you can leave to the market and what has to be decided through policy and regulation, which is probably a bit of a, a, a large esoteric question to bite off in a minute or two. So we'll save that for another podcast discussion and move on now to crystal ball time. So bringing out and dusting off after its summer break, the Talking New Energy crystal ball, and set the dial to 2025. So 5 years time, or well, time's flying by, nearly 4 years, four and a bit years time. And I'd like to ask each of you to give an example, it might be building on something we've talked about, of a really progressive regulation you'd like to see and that you think's got a reasonable chance of being in place by 2025. And you can pick your country or your region or your state. So Rich, let's start with you. What would you love to see in place by 2025?
Well, we haven't really talked about wholesale power markets. I think that what I'd like to see is a robust market for flexible resources on the grid side, but also flexible resources that come from customers that can balance the variable generation from wind and solar in an economically efficient way, and a market that draws the most cost-effective sources of that flexibility. So I think that you talk about a kind of wonky behind-the-scenes thing. This is a very wonky behind-the-scenes thing that could really change everything. So okay. That's what I would like to see fully developed in perhaps many wholesale markets in Europe and the United States by 2025.
And I didn't say this in the prep, but which country or state or region or wholesale market region do you think would you put your money on, or who's making really good progress, or who's a good candidate for that?
Well, this is a Kentucky Derby with a dozen horses in the race, and I probably would bet the field. I think all of them will be thinking about this.
Yeah.
If I had to judge, I'd say one of the Northern European RTOs and perhaps Texas and the New England market in the U.S.
Okay. Thanks. Jan, how about you? 2025, what would you love to see in place in four and a bit years' time?
So I pick electrification that is smart as an area where I want to see more progress. You know, we talked about this earlier on, but we're adding all that new load to the system, and we still install charging infrastructure for electric vehicles in many countries. We still install heat pumps in buildings, but we don't have smartness built into them. And that's really something that could be fixed relatively easily by requiring a certain functionality of smartness, which then in turn enables the kinds of things that Rich talked about, markets to actually procure some of those services. But we got to make sure that the technology we roll out is actually smart and is ready to provide those services. And that's why I would like to see regulation to make inroads and to be much more consistent and give clear signals to industry as well, so they know what they have to plan for. Which countries will be leaders in that area? I guess it's those countries that are pushing ahead the fastest with the electrification of the transport system, of the buildings that they have. And it remains to be seen which countries those are. I mean, the Nordics we talked about a lot, but I think there's a race going on, and we don't know yet which countries will emerge as leaders in that. So I'm keeping my bets open for now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I've just installed a heat pump in my house, hybrid heat pump along with a gas boiler. And what tipped my choice on the brand of heat pump, and I won't say which brand, was the smartness and openness of the controls. So hopefully my heat pump will be able to bid into demand side flexibility markets in the not too distant future.
That's good to hear, John. You're really one of the avant-garde doing this, and I'm in the same boat. I'm doing the same thing with my own heat pump.
Yeah, great. And Susanna, from your point of view, what would you love to see from a regulation perspective in 2025?
Well, I would like to see companies to explore a wide range of options, much wider than today. they can serve their consumers. You know, options, for example, for network companies, not only confined to the siting of new station, whether we put it here or there, but including alternative ways to deal with congestions, let's say, in the low voltage level. So tools that would make the consumers a bit network management managers without, of course, them knowing it. So what I would like to see that these regulated companies, they team up with non-energy companies that bring in new solutions and they do it together. So without naming winners, I would say the winners would be those who essentially very, very successful in third parties. So new actors to the otherwise quite traditional stage of energy policy and energy system actors, so non-energy actors. I think that's the trick.
Okay, and an example of a, I guess, one of those third parties or a country where you see this happening, or is it too early to say?
Well, I would say that the natural coupling would be lots of IT companies moving to the energy sphere, which is already happening in many of the states, especially in the US.
Great. Well, let's keep our, well, I was going to say keep our fingers crossed that we see these things in 2025, but I guess that will be down to the hard work of all of you at the Regulatory Assistance Project, of regulators themselves, of people working with regulators, and so on. So thanks so much to Rich, Jan, and Susanna for joining us. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, as always, to you for listening to the podcast. We hope you found it interesting. I think, personally, regulation is sometimes put in the hard but less exciting box, but is an absolutely critical part of the jigsaw for the energy transition. And I hope we've given you a good taste of what's happening across Europe and the US today. So thanks very much for joining us. Thanks to my guests, and look forward to welcoming you back to the next episode next week. Goodbye.
If you're as passionate about the energy transition as we are, then please keep in touch. You can follow us and me on Twitter, LinkedIn, or subscribe to the podcasts on your chosen podcast platform. If you like the podcast and like sharing, then please do rate us. And to listen to archived episodes, to read transcripts, and to see the latest Delta EE insights, then please visit www.delta-ee.com.